Good morning, and welcome to the Pioneer Museum. My name is John Russell, and we're happy to be able to present kind of an overview lecture. Nothing too specific. This is not for college credit, and there will be no quiz at the end. But just an overall view of the past, the heritage of Gallatin County. And in addition to welcoming you to the Pioneer Museum, I suppose I should welcome you to Many Come Together Country, because that is what the Blackfeet Indians referred to as this valley. The Blackfeet lived to the north-northwest of the valley. They kind of controlled the Three Forks area, but the valley as a whole was a crossroads area for several American Indian tribes. Okay, to the south, you had the Bannock tribe, also the Shoshones. Further to the west, the Nez Perce, the Flathead tribe. And then to the east, the Crow tribe. And a lot of these different tribes crisscrossed through this valley on their way to various hunting grounds, as well as to hunt in this area itself. Hence, that's how it became the crossroads, and that's why the Indians referred to it as Many Come Together Country. Contrary to the legend of the Valley of the Flowers, where it said that there would be no fighting between the tribes in this valley, not quite true. There was some warfare between the tribes. But as late as the 1880s, after the town was established, once a year, Chief Tendoy would lead the Bannock tribe to the Yellowstone Valley. The Yellowstone Valley was their Costco, as it was for the Shoshone, as it was for the Nez Perce. That's where the huge buffalo herds were. There was hunting available in this valley, but primarily it was the Yellowstone Valley. And that's why the Indians fought so tenaciously to hold that valley. And we all know that culminated with the Little Bighorn in 1876 when Custer got sued. S-I-O-U-X-E-D. But anyway, as late as the 1880s, Bannock tribe would come down Main Street and camp around Bozeman for a few days before proceeding on over into the Yellowstone Valley to do hunting. And if anybody ever asked you, what was the first parade in Bozeman, you could say it was the Bannock tribe coming through and making themselves at home for a few days before they went over to the Yellowstone Valley. Some women here in town would complain that they'd be in their kitchen. They might be making dough, rolling out dough or something, and look at the window, and here's a couple of Indians right at the window staring at them, hoping that they might be able to get some coffee or sugar. Some of the braves from the Bannock tribe would have races with some of the cowboys from around this area, horse races. And many of the Indians, year in, year out, as long as that tradition continued, they were attracted by the music coming from one home, from the Wilson home, Lester and Emma Weeks Wilson. Emma Weeks Wilson was a very accomplished musician, very good pianist, and was said to have a beautiful voice. And her singing on a day such as this today would draw the Indians to that house, and they would all stand around just to listen to this white man's music that they found so beautiful. But we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves. Lewis and Clark, as we bounce back, as you probably all know, Lewis and Clark came through here in 1805 on their way out to the Pacific Coast, actually to the Three Forks of the Missouri, and from there proceeded on to the Pacific. They named the three rivers that formed the Missouri, the Madison, the Jefferson, and one of them was the Gallatin. That was named for Albert Gallatin, a guy named Al. He was the Secretary of the Treasury under Thomas Jefferson. He's the one who put all the money together for the Lewis and Clark expedition. That's how we got Gallatin River, Gallatin Valley, Gallatin County, Gallatin Canyon, Gallatin Gateway, and he never traveled west of the Mississippi. But that's our county's namesake. But that was kind of typical of Lewis and Clark. The Judith River in central Montana, Judith Basin, Judith Gap. Clark named that for his sweetheart back in Virginia, Judith. She never came out here. But she married him when he got back, so I guess she must have been impressed. Probably a good thing that the Lewis and Clark expedition ended when it did. They were running out of names. The Shields River over by Livingston was named for one of the expedition members. In 1806, when Lewis and Clark made their return journey, they split up roughly where Missoula is now. Clark proceeded on over back to the Three Forks with a portion of the expedition. Lewis went up to explore the Milk River. and he would then proceed down the Missouri. Clark was to get to the Yellowstone, proceed down the Yellowstone, and they would meet at the confluence of the two. So from the Three Forks, they came right across this valley. And you can imagine William Clark up there at the Three Forks. Here it is. He's going to take a land route to get to the Yellowstone River. He's looking around. He kind of eyes the Flathead Pass and thinks, well, maybe that's a good way to get over to where the Yellowstone is. And the poor guy, the first guy in this area who had to ask for directions. A guy had, and what made it even tougher, who did he have to ask for directions? A teenage girl named Sacagawea. So anyway, she instructed him that the Flathead Pass would not be the best way to go. Because she was a Shoshone girl, she had been raised in the Three Forks area. She knew this valley quite well. So she led them right across this valley. As a matter of fact, they would have come through where the up on North 7th where that little statue of Sacagawea is. That's pretty close to where they came through. And then they turned right at the Senior Center. Of course, the Senior Center was not open at the time, but they turned right at the Senior Center. And for years, the Lewis and Clark nuts, as they described themselves, Lewis and Clark buffs, they argued whether Clark turned left at Lindley Park or Bozeman Deaconess Hospital. Well, after years of debate and study and reading the journals, they concluded he turned left at Bozeman Deaconess Hospital. So, and then they camped at the base of Kelly Canyon, and then the next day went over. Up through Kelly Canyon, that's where the Bozeman Trail would actually be, all right? The Bozeman Trail, or the trail that Clark followed Sacagawea to get out of this valley, did not follow where the interstate is. You couldn't get through Rocky Canyon. No way. Okay? But when Clark was in this valley, he wrote of the innumerable beaver dams and the sound of beaver tails hitting the water. The valley was a huge swamp. These little buggers made dams all over the place. You know where we have all of these mountain streams that come down and feed either the east or the west Gallatin. Imagine a good portion of these backed up, kind of many, many morasses and just swampy. When word of that got out, here comes the fur trade era. One of those involved was John Coulter, who happened to be on the Lewis and Clark. And Coulter, as a matter of fact, turned around from the Mandan villages. He didn't even go all the way back home. He came back with some fur trappers. They trapped in this valley, and they had problems with the Blackfeet. Again, the Blackfeet were primarily to the north and the west. However, they did control the Three Forks area, and these were not the type of people to set up a welcome wagon. They didn't like the fur traders in their territory. And so Coulter, you've probably heard the infamous story about how he and his companion, his buddy, were captured by the Blackfeet. They killed his companion, stripped him naked, gave him a head start, and their best warriors were chasing him with spears. He outran all of them except one. Coulter stopped and turned on this guy who tripped, broke his spear in half. Coulter picked up the pointed end of the spear and killed him. And then Coulter ran on to the Jefferson River, a log jam in the Jefferson River, dove in the water, swam into the log jam, and hid there for about a day. And then the rest of the Blackfeet gave up looking for him. John Coulter walked from the Three Forks of the Missouri to Fort Manuel Lisa, which was over by present-day Billings, naked, barefoot, living on roots and grasshoppers. He made it. When he got there, his feet were so torn up from the cactus, it took him a couple of weeks to recuperate. But once he was back to full health, the first thing this guy did is he came right back to the Three Forks because, damn it, he wanted his traps back. So this guy had a lot, you could say this guy was either insane or he had a lot of guts. Probably a mixture of both. Coulter was with them when Jacob Astor Fur Company established a fort at the Three Forks, but again, it was under constant siege by the Blackfeet Indians. And although the area had great potential for trapping beaver, they gave it up. Several were killed. John Coulter went back after surviving all these Indian attacks, after surviving the Lewis and Clark expedition. Because he was on the Lewis and Clark expedition, he was entitled to, I think, 160 acres, a gift from the government. He goes back home to Missouri and starts his little farm and what have you, and he's out of here for good, and he dies in his mid-30s of jaundice after everything he had been through out here. The fur trade did pick up again a little bit in the 1820s. Jim Bridger was one of those who came up here. Kit Carson came through this area in the 1830s. Tom Fitzpatrick, you name some of the famous fur traders. Most of them did come through here. One of the delays for the resumption of the fur trade was the War of 1812 and the economic conditions. And by about the 1830s, silk imported from the Far East started to put the demand for beaver pelts out of business. The beaver pelts were prized to make hats. Well, the silk hats were starting to come into fashion. That pretty much put the kibosh on the fur trade. Other things, naturalists passed through here making notes on the fauna, the geography. In the 1840s up into the 1850s. Father Pierre Jean de Smet of the Society of Jesus came through here quite often on his way to the Flatheads or the Nez Perce tribe. And he describes in his journals about how he was being escorted by the Flatheads through this valley to their homeland. And he talks about how they came across a huge buffalo herd up by the Three Forks. And he describes this buffalo hunt that occurred up there. And if you ever saw the film Dancing with Wolves, the way he described it, it was exactly like something out of that. They killed quite a few buffalo. The Indians, of course, did not waste any of it. They took it all with them, and so this was a kind of a good food cache for them. Saved them a trip over to the Costco in the Yellowstone Valley. But that was kind of a nice food cache for them. And not too many people really passed through until the 1850s. And in the 1850s, a couple of developments nationally. First of all, California Gold Rush, we all know, the 49ers. And also Pikes Peak Gold Rush in Colorado. And those who went to those respective gold rushes and didn't have much luck, they started to fan out into other portions of the Rocky Mountains to try and find gold. They found some good silver lodes in Nevada, some promising strikes in Idaho, and some wandered as far north as what is now Montana in the 1850s. And gold was found near present-day Deer Lodge. And in the early 1860s, a really promising strike was made along what is called Grasshopper Creek. And they established a mining camp there, and they named the mining camp for the nearby Indian tribe, the Bannocks. That's how we got Bannock, one of the first gold mining camps in what at that time was Idaho Territory. And a couple of miners who were in Bannock decided to go over to the Yellowstone Valley and let's see what's over there. Maybe there might be some promising finds. Well, they ran into some Crows who took just about all their horses and disarmed most of them and basically kicked them out. These guys made their way slowly. They crossed this valley, made their way slowly back towards Bannock, and then they camped in the gravelly mountain range along a creek that was shielded by alder bushes, and they tried their luck at finding gold there, and they found some real promising nuggets. And again, this is just plain old placer mining. And it was a very promising strike, and one of the guys named the region Alder, or he named the creek Alder Creek because of the alder bushes. And they said, we got to go back to Bannock and get some more supplies and come back here because this could be big. Now, when we're in Bannock, everybody keep their mouths shut. Apparently, Tom Cover was the one who spilled the beans. Miners cannot keep secrets. And besides, the miners who were in Bannock were not stupid. They understood, boy, these guys are buying a lot of supplies. They're getting fresh horses, picks. New pants? What are these guys up to? These guys leave Bannock to head back to Alder Creek, and they're being followed by about 200 guys. And they keep going. Finally, they stop at Beaverhead Rock, and they have a great big meeting, and they say, all right, the jig's up. Yeah, we found some promising strikes. We'll show you other guys where it is, but we get first shot at the claims. And the other said, you got a deal. Hence the beginning of Virginia City. And what also became Nevada City. As a matter of fact, eventually there were so many communities along Alder Creek, it was all referred to as Nine Mile City because it was 9 miles long. Okay, and we all know about the lawlessness. We all know about the vigilantes. A lot of them probably, it was a dangerous place to live. It really was. A little girl, Mary Ronan, that was her married name later in life. She recalled as a little girl in Virginia City, her mother would want her to go down to the butcher shop and tell her to please run there and run back. It's literally because of bullets ricocheting out of the saloons and hurdy-gurdy houses. It was a pretty rough place. And yeah, a lot of miners were getting robbed and getting killed, their gold stolen from them. Hence came the vigilantes. And the vigilantes, as we know, put an end to all of that in a short spate of time. But with the establishment of that camp and the 10,000 some odd people who were in there by the end of 1865, some people eyed this valley because they could see its agricultural potential and the potential to grow, to establish farms and ranches and grow foodstuffs to these miners. One of those who recognized the potential was a guy from Georgia, John Bozeman. He had been here since about 1862, panning for gold. He got tired of being up to his neck in ice-cold water over an Alder Creek, and he comes across this old frontiersman, John Jacobs. You know, we have in downtown Bozeman, Jacobs Crossing. That's the namesake, John Jacobs, because he was familiar with this valley, and he also told Bozeman about a series of Indian trails that would cut through the Bighorn Basin in present-day Wyoming on the east side of the Bighorn Mountains down to the Oregon Trail. In those days, if you were coming to the gold fields of Montana, you stayed on the Oregon Trail until you got to Fort Hall. That is present-day Pocatello, okay, and the Fort Hall Reservation is still there. Then you turn north, basically following I-15, but, of course, there were no road workers at the time, and you would come into the mining camps that way. This series of trails across the Bighorn Basin could save 200 to 300 miles and save a lot of precious time. So John Bozeman and Jacob's little daughter, they go down there in 1864. They want to go to the Oregon Trail and recruit some people to come up here and charge them money to lead them to the Gallatin Valley. And, well, they got nailed by the Sioux and the Cheyenne. The Crow took a lot of their stuff from them. John Bozeman and Jacobs, they had to walk, I think, the last 100 miles. The little girl helped to dig up roots for them to live on and insects. But he made it to roughly almost all the way to Scott's Bluff. They recuperated, and they recruited some people to come up this new road that Bozeman was touting. Well, when they get near present-day Buffalo, Wyoming, they're met by the Sioux again. Make them turn around. John Bozeman and a couple of guys snuck through by going on the other side of the Bighorn Mountains and coming into the Gallatin Valley via the Yellowstone. They just had a few horses with them. They were low on supplies by the time they got here. They camped on the pass up there in 1864. And the guys who were with John Bozeman were so impressed with his courage, with his leadership, they named the pass the Bozeman Pass. So it was named in 1864. Or excuse me, 1863, I'm sorry. That was 1863 when all that occurred. That didn't deter John Bozeman. The following year, 1864, he goes down via Denver and back up over by Fort Laramie, and he recruits another wagon train, and he leads this wagon train, and this one makes it. There are other wagon trains coming into the Gallatin Valley that year and subsequent years. Jim Bridger led one in that actually got here before John Bozeman did. But Bozeman's got more of the publicity when he led that train in here in late July 1864. Some of his friends, Rouse, Elliot Rouse, for example, they stayed here and they laid out a town site. And upon John Bozeman's arrival, the Claims Association had a meeting. All these people who were making claims under the Homestead Act, and they decided to name the new town for John Bozeman. And a month later, they almost changed the name. The Civil War was still having an effect out here. If you go back to Virginia City, it had been proposed initially that the community be called Verina. Verina was the name of Jefferson Davis's wife, Verina Davis, the First Lady of the Confederacy. But there was a Union sympathizing judge over there who said, no way are we going to name a town for the secesh. So he got it changed to Virginia City. This community in 1864, most of the people who were coming in here were Union sympathizers, pro-Republicans, pro-Lincoln. Where was John Bozeman from? Georgia. John Bozeman was a Democrat. Republicans in those days looked at the Democrats as the party of rebellion because most Democrats, copperheads, were sympathizers with the Confederacy. Another thing, too, is time went by. John Bozeman, he established some toll bridges, some ferries along the Yellowstone, and people thought he was really charging confiscatory prices. At one crossing, in order to get the ferry to come across the river, he was charging $10 a wagon. And a bunch of wagons came in, and they said, what? You want how much? $10. No, we're not going to pay it. The first traffic jam in Montana was a series of Conestoga wagons backed up along the Yellowstone River, a bunch of people thumbing their nose at John Bozeman, saying, we're not going to pay that. He finally lowered the price to $7, and they grudgingly agreed to pay that. But they remembered that when they settled in this valley. They weren't big friends of his. As time continued to go by, Bozeman kind of got in the bad habit of idling his time a little too much in the saloon, drinking whiskey and playing poker. That didn't sit too good with the God-fearing people. And then when the Civil War ended, you know, there was a lady in here a couple of months ago. She was from North Carolina, and I was basically explaining this. And she was very polite, but she stopped me and she said, sir, it was not the Civil War. It was the War of Northern Aggression. Okay. So, some of those folks are still fighting it. Whatever your preference. Civil War, War of Northern Aggression, war between the states. Confederate veterans at the conclusion of the conflict started to migrate west, looking for a new start in life. A lot of them settled around here. As a matter of fact, not far from Helena, they found some promising gold deposits, and that's how we got Confederate Gulch up by Helena. But if there's one person they couldn't stand more than a Yankee, it was a fellow Southerner who had not been in uniform serving the Stars and Bars during the War of Northern Aggression, John Bozeman. And then to top it all off, John Bozeman, he was not the most handsome man on the planet, but he did have an appeal to the ladies. He could turn the ladies' heads. So if you had a wife, a daughter, or a girlfriend, John Bozeman made you a little nervous. So, if you were Union, you didn't like him. If you were Confederate, you didn't like him. If you remembered those confiscatory rates on the Bozeman Trail, you didn't like him. And if you were married, or you had a sweetheart, or you had a daughter, you didn't like him. Somewhere he must have had a few friends. We're still trying to find out. Some of those were the reason that the Claims Association had another meeting and said, what were we thinking of naming this town for this guy? Let's change it. Let's change the name to Montana City. And they debated, and they argued, and then they took their vote, and the motion lost by one vote. William Alderson cast the vote to keep it as Bozeman. He says, look, it's on the Platts. Come on, we can live with it. And from that day forward, William Alderson always liked to call himself the man who named the town. He considered himself to be the one who saw to it that the name of Bozeman stayed. In 1867, John Bozeman and Tom Cover, the same Tom Cover who helped to find the gold in Alder Gulch, they left here to go to the Bozeman Trail forts to negotiate some contracts for Gallatin Valley flour. And this was in April. And legend has it, there was a couple here that had a boarding house, the Fraziers, George and Elvira Frazier. Legend has it that they were out on the front stoop of the Frazier house, and they saw these two ride out of town. And Elmira Frazier says to her husband, well, there goes John Bozeman. Isn't he handsome? And George says, yes, he is. And wife, take a good long look at John Bozeman because he's one dead son of a... Whether or not that really happened, we don't know, but boy, it makes good theater, you know. A day later, Tom Cover comes into Nelson Story's cow camp over on the Yellowstone. He's got a bullet wound in the shoulder. We got jumped by Blackfeet, me and Bozeman. John's dead. He was killed at the scene. I got shot in the back, and the bullet came out my shoulder before they fled, before the Indians fled. But there were powder burns on the front of his wound. Nelson Story sent one of his scouts over there to examine the scene, and this guy could find absolutely positively no evidence of Indians anywhere. John Bozeman's body was not scalped. Nothing was taken from him. There were no discerning marks that would show Indian ponies had even been there. We don't know for certain. People kind of kept it quiet back then. Many historians still believe the Blackfeet were responsible, but a lot of the evidence suggests it was Tom Cover who killed John Bozeman and then shot himself in the shoulder to make it look like he had been in a scrape, because Tom Cover thought John was paying a little too much attention to Mrs. Cover. Again, we don't know for certain. May or may not be true, but boy, it makes good theater. Anyway, so that's one of the legends that continues on. And then from there, the community continued to struggle and grow. Placer mining started to wane a little bit. And there was a lot of warfare along the Bozeman Trail, the Bloody Bozeman, Red Clouds War, that lasted until 1868. Hundreds of people were killed trying to come up the Bozeman Trail. And finally, the government agreed to close the forts on the Bozeman Trail. The only time in American history when the U.S. government signed a treaty whereby the U.S. government's only request was peace was the treaty that ended Red Cloud's War in 1868. The Indians basically won it. But General Sherman, the head of the army, was not an idiot. He knew, let's be patient. We'll get the railroad through. And after we slaughter the buffalo, then they'll give up. But that's another story. 1867, these forts closing, but the government grudgingly agrees to establish a fort near Bozeman because of these raids in the Yellowstone Valley and the threat that the Sioux and the Cheyenne were now presenting to the Crow tribe, which for the most part was friendly with the whites. The Crow Reservation was over in the Yellowstone Valley. At that time, the Crow Reservation included everything south of the Yellowstone River and north of the Wyoming line all the way over to the Bighorn River. The Paradise Valley, over by Livingston, that was Crow land. You can see where, through time, we've pushed them to, over by Hardin. I don't want any of you good folks from eastern Montana to throw any tomatoes, but Hardin is not the end of the world, but you can see it from there, I think. And good, there's no... I like Hardin. There's a lot of history over there and what have you, but... Anyhow, the Fort Ellis Fort is established here in Bozeman. The fort was named for a Union Army officer who was killed at Gettysburg, Augustus Van Horn Ellis. Fort Ellis was named by who probably never heard of, because Montana Territory didn't even exist at the time of Gettysburg. But that was typical of the Army. They named their forts for those who fell in battle. But with Fort Ellis, it was viewed immediately with all the soldiers coming in and building this fort. It was viewed immediately as the fort that saved Bozeman. A lot of people like to say it's saving us from the Indian attacks. Well, there were a few raids into the valley, nothing serious. The reason the fort was the fort that saved Bozeman is because it saved Bozeman economically. The Army had to buy supplies. The Army had to buy feed and grain for the horses. The Army had to buy foodstuffs for the soldiers. The soldiers needed a place when they were on leave, after they got paid. They needed a place to go and, you know, let their hair down and buy a pretty girl a drink. It didn't take very long for this community. Suddenly, you had more saloons and, shall we say, hotels for single girls than you did churches. That didn't take long. And the male population of the entire area grew quite dramatically. But again, placer mining starting to wane, this was an economic boon. Bear in mind, Lewis and Clark, and the first publicity of this valley, financed by the federal government. Fort Ellis, the fort that saved Bozeman, financed by the federal government. And the fort would be there for about 20-some-odd years. More people came into the valley at the tail end of the 1860s. One of them was a 17-year-old girl named Sarah Tracy. She had just married William Tracy back east. He had gone back to get her, and they'd come back. They went up by riverboat to Fort Benton and took a wagon road and came to Bozeman, and she got here in I think it was late June, and they stayed at the Guy House. It was one of the first hotels in the community. And she wrote about it later. They sat down for dinner and a lot of other people there, and she kind of looked around and noticed in this crowd of about 30 or 40, the only other women were Mrs. Guy, Mrs. Frazier, Mrs. Nelson Story, and herself. Gives you an idea. Imagine this poor girl, 17 years old, just got here. She's sitting down for dinner. You have all these young bachelors sitting around looking at her like this. Yeah. So there was a large proportion of men to women for quite some time, and it stayed that way until the early 1870s. But it became the granary of Montana. It was definitely one of the, probably the finest agricultural region in the territory at the time. That was what really propelled its growth. And even though the Bozeman Trail was shut down, with the presence of the fort, you had a ready market right there for your goods. Should mention Nelson Story. He was one of those who came up, he and Ellen, in 1863 to Bannock. Then they immediately went to Virginia City. She was one of the first women in Virginia City, Ellen Story was. Her first home in Montana territory was a beat-up little tent alongside Alder Creek. Nelson Story had some success panning for gold. He rode with the vigilantes. He also made some pretty good money selling goods to the other miners over there. And by early 1866, he had accumulated about $30,000 in gold dust. So he had done quite well for himself. And he kind of kept track of what was going on back east. And one thing he learned was that down in Texas, during the Civil War, with all the guys gone fighting for the Confederacy, the population of long-born cattle herds just exploded. Just roamed free over unclaimed territory. There was nobody there to control them, nobody there to herd them. They just proliferated. And when the war ended, there were so many longhorns in Texas, people could buy them for $2 to $3 a head. In Chicago, now that the markets had reopened after the war, you could get $40 a head for them. Here comes the days of the cattle drives, right after the Civil War. That's what made it so potentially profitable. Story leaves here. Ellen's about to have a, well, Ellen just gave birth to their first child. Nothing personal, dear, but I'm going east. He goes all the way back to New York City with his $30,000 in gold dust, and he cashes it in at the Kuntz Brothers Bank for $40,000 in greenbacks. The greenbacks were still in circulation. They are what financed the Civil War, and the exchange rate was so favorable to the greenbacks. Just by going all the way to New York, he made an additional $10,000. Good money in 1866. He gets down to Texas. Somewhere along the way, his initial intent, Nelson Story did not intend to bring any cattle to Montana. He wanted to take the cattle to Sedalia, Missouri, to the railhead, and ship them right up to Chicago and make another quick buck. But somewhere along the way, he changed his mind. And instead, he decided to bring them up here to Montana Territory. And he goes by way of Fort Leavenworth, where he buys some new Sharps carbine breech-loading rifles, brand spanking new. The next best thing in those days to an automatic rifle that you could get. They were better rifles than what the Army had. The Army still had the single shot, you know, you got to clean the barrel after. They had better rifles than the Army, he and his men. He hires more men in Leavenworth. They go up past Fort Kearney on the Oregon Trail. They get to Fort Laramie. He's got a herd of close to 1,000 longhorns, close to 1,000. But he's also got a lot of wagons to bring goods up here to establish a mercantile store in Bozeman. And at Fort Laramie, the Army says, you know, there's a lot of fighting up on that Bozeman Trail. You might be advised to stay on the Oregon Trail and continue on that way. But Story didn't want to do that. He was in a hurry to get into the Yellowstone Valley before winter set in. He was in Fort Laramie in late August. So he proceeds up the Bozeman Trail, and they do have some running fights with the Sioux, but when the Sioux got a taste of those breech loaders, they backed off. Story gets all the way up to Fort Phil Kearny, and the commander there says, "You don't have enough men to proceed on the Bozeman Trail. You're going to have to stay here and wait for more people to come up the Bozeman Trail until you have a total group of 40, then we'll let you go." Well, Story had close to 30 guys. He says, "Wait a minute, I've made it this far. We're doing fine." He said, Colonel Carrington was the commander. He says, "Nope, you stay here. You camp 2 miles south of the fort, and when more people come in, you can proceed." Story camps there for 2 weeks. One of his men is killed by Indians, and finally he gets fed up. He rightly concludes Carrington held him up because Carrington wanted those cattle for the army. Carrington did make Story an offer, and Story told him to go jump in the lake. He wasn't selling them. So one night, Story gets all of his herders together, and he says, "Look, it's early October. Winter's going to be here any time. We got to get out of here. Carrington won't let us go. I propose we sneak out of here at night, do a huge arc around the fort, and then come back to the Bozeman Trail and keep going." Every one of his herders voted yes. "Yeah, let's get out of here. To hell with Carrington and the army." Except one guy. One guy voted to stay. His name was George Dow. Story orders George Dow tied up, gagged, and tossed into the back of a wagon so he won't tell anybody. And they sneak out at night. And it is amazing. They got out undetected. Carrington, the next morning after Story had put 10 miles between him and the fort, Carrington was just furious, absolutely furious. He thought about sending a contingent up to Story, but he decided against it. From there, Nelson Story's cattle drive continued, and he established his cow camp where Livingston is today. He only had his cattle in the Gallatin Valley briefly when there were some heavy snows and Indian raids in the Yellowstone Valley. He would bring the cattle in here for safekeeping. But Nelson Story's cow camp was over where present-day Livingston is. And that was the nucleus for his future wealth. From there, he got into banking, real estate. Eventually, he became a miller. In the early 1870s, he hears that in Southern California, ranchers down there, Mustangs had overpopulated. And they're killing Mustangs much like we would coyotes. They just proliferate in population. Story knows that Mustangs are damn good cow ponies. So he and a bunch of his cowboys go to Southern California. The guy got around pretty good. They go to Southern California. And while they're down there negotiating to buy some of these Mustangs, they ride through a very, very small, rinky, dinky little Spanish town named Los Angeles. And he's kind of impressed with the area. He likes the area. And he kind of keeps that in the back of his mind in the future. Well, to make a long story short, they got the Mustangs. They return back up here. This gives him the nucleus of a very good horse herd. As time goes by, he wins contracts. He and Leander Black, as in Black Avenue. Leander Black came here from Colorado. He had connections with the Grant administration. He helped Story get the contracts to sell to the government for the Crow Nation and their reservation over in the Yellowstone Valley. Leander Black made a lot of money at it. He eventually went broke after the Panic of 1873 and relocated to Helena and died relatively young. But Story stayed on, and the accusations flew that Nelson Story would deliver barrels that's supposed to be full of meat for the tribe, and you open it up and it's hiding bones. And because he had guys in the army he was paying, they approved it, and he would get his voucher. He was accused of double sacking flour. Typically, you take a sack of flour, when you deliver it to the reservation, the clerk over there would stamp the sack, then pour the flour into a bin. You get the sack, that's your receipt. That's your voucher. Story would come over, guy would stamp the outer sack, undo it. "Hey, another sack." Stamp it again. Get paid twice for one sack of flour. Those were the accusations. And the accusations got strong enough to where a grand jury was called to investigate whether there should be fraud charges against Nelson Story. But the grand jury said there wasn't enough evidence to take him to trial, which made a lot of people mad because they looked at Story as a crook. So he was never convicted of anything, but he did, after that grand jury was dispersed, he did brag that it cost him $10,000 to bribe that grand jury. So anyway, time goes on, his wealth increases, and he eventually in the 1880s builds this really nice mansion, the Story Mansion. If it were still standing, it would be right across the street and up by the corner here with Fifth. That house on South Wilson is not the Story Mansion, as the media calls it. I know, Russell, it's not a big deal. The Story Mansion was built in 1886. It was built to last 500 years. It had 13 rooms, including a ballroom. It was the first structure in town to have running water, gas, heat. All of the bricks, and there's pictures of it upstairs, all of the bricks were dipped in stale beer to preserve their color. I have no idea what it is about stale beer that preserves the color, but it worries the hell out of me after some of that stuff I drank in college. You know? So what if the beer has been sitting on the counter for 2 days? You know, it's still beer. You know, when you're in college, you think beer is food. Anyhow. But then eventually, later on, and remind me to come back to it, we'll talk about why that mansion was torn down. But with Story, another thing too, with the wealth he accumulated, he and Ellen and their family became the first snowbirds. He bought a mansion in the Adams District of Los Angeles. Okay, in those days, that was the blue blood section. That was for the hooey palooey. It's located where the Southern California USC campus is today. So it's pretty much in a rough neighborhood right now. But back then, that was the bee's knees if you were going to live in L.A. Story invests wisely in real estate along Broadway Avenue in Los Angeles and Spring Street. He and his son Walter in 1911 built one of the first skyscrapers in Los Angeles. And it's still there at 5th and Broadway, downtown L.A. I don't think it was the very first skyscraper, but it was one of the early ones. It's the Story Building. If you're ever in downtown Los Angeles, and you say, oh, the Story Building, yeah. It says Walter P. Story Building for his son. But he built a lot. That's where he and his family really went to town, was in Southern California real estate. Made a fortune. Let's backpedal just a little bit. Early 1870s, you recall how here in Gallatin County, just a couple of years ago, we went through this big debate and fight over a new county jail and how the county commission, how voters finally approved it. In 1873, the county commission at that time said to Bozeman voters, or I should say to Gallatin County residents, we need a new jail. That was the first time this happened. The one we've got only holds a couple of guys. The guys that were currently being held in that jail, one was a guy known as W.A. Triplett. He doubled as a town drunk, and he was also accused of murder. And another one was a pimp, Steamboat Bill, who had killed a Chinese prostitute here in town. They're being held in the jail. The suggestion by the county didn't sit well with the people like Nelson Story or Lester Wilson or Peter Koch or any of your other Leander Black, any of your other early movers and shakers. So one night, a crowd of men gets together. Some of them detain the sheriff. The other part of the crowd breaks into the jail. They grab those two guys. They take them to an abandoned butcher shop where City Hall is right now, and they hang them, both of them. And there's a picture of those two guys swinging in the breeze. And their message to the county commission was very clear. We do not need another jail. We need fewer prisoners. And that was how you made your point back in those days. We eventually did get a jail, but it took until 1878 before they finally built another jail. In the mid-1880s, the Indian Wars are pretty much over, and troops from Fort Ellis participated in some major campaigns. They were part of the Montana Column in the Sioux War of 1876. Some of the guys stationed here were among the first to find what was left of Custer along the Little Bighorn. But the fort closes in 1886 because, again, the Indian Wars are pretty much over. And there's concern, oh boy, there goes the fort. Now what? The railroad had made it here in 1883, and that was good news, okay, because that helped open markets east and west. And they had a great big celebration up by Helena driving the Golden Spike. All right, here's one of those trivia things that you can wow them with at your next cocktail party. When somebody asks, who is the... It was in the paper about a year ago when President Obama came here, and the media, gee, how many presidents have come here? How many former presidents have come here? Anybody have any idea who the first former president of the U.S. to come and see Bozeman would be? I'm sorry? You got it. Ulysses S. Grant in 1883. He was part of, with Jay Cook, part of that group that came out because he was up for the Golden Spike ceremony. So, yeah, he was the first former president to see Bozeman in the Gallatin Valley. But the railroad was of help, but still the fort closed. But in 1889, Montana becomes a state, gets statehood, 41st state. And the legislature decides, despite the fact that Helena had been the territorial capital, let's put it to a vote of the people. Should we keep the capital in Helena? Maybe there's another town that wants it. Butte wanted it. Anaconda wanted it. Great Falls wanted it. Missoula said, forget it, we're too far west. Billings said, forget it, we're too far east. And Bozeman wanted it. So then comes the publicity campaign to become the state capital. And the people here in Bozeman, the promoters behind this, thought it was duck soup that Bozeman was going to become the capital. We're going to be the state capital. We need to make this town look better. Bada bing. That's where the Bozeman Hotel came from. They started to build that Bozeman Hotel in anticipation of becoming the capital. South 8th, the way it's designed, with the big median in the middle, going up, that's where the capital was going to be. South 8th was laid out in that design to take you to the Capitol building. Same with South Wilson and the fancy, neat lights along it. All of these things coming into place. A new subdivision is established. It would be so stylish to be able to live within eyesight of the Capitol. So they create a new subdivision up there. And to this day, it's still called Capitol Hill Edition. All those homes that are around MSU today. All of these things are done. They start their publicity campaign. They go across the state. Their editorials say Bozeman has to be the state capital because, after all, we have the healthiest environment. We have the freshest air. We have the finest kept lawns, the widest picket fences. We have the healthiest babies and the prettiest girls of anybody in the territory. Of course we got it. We all know what happened. In the runoff vote, it came down to Anaconda or Helena. And the prize went to Helena. And so the legislature decided to give Bozeman a consolation prize, the Montana College of Mechanical and Agricultural Arts. Today, it is, of course, MSU. I think we got the better end of the deal. You know, all things considered. But anyhow, with the establishment of that college, a federal land-grant college, Uncle Sam to the rescue once again. That helped to stabilize the economy of this community. And as time goes by and the agrarian value of the valley grows and along with the population and, Belgrade was established in 1883 as a railroad siding for the Northern Pacific Railroad. Jay Cook had hoped to bring the NPR into the Gallatin Valley in the 1870s, but you had the panic of 1873, and then you had survey parties under constant attack in the Yellowstone Valley by the Sioux and Cheyenne. So it was delayed. When it was time to try the railroad again, he recruited a lot of investors from Yugoslavia. Okay? Tom Qua, who's a real estate guy here in Bozeman, figures, hey, if we put a siding out there, we could put a mill. all these farmers out in this part of the valley, it's a hell of a lot better if they can get their grain on the train out here than having to come into Bozeman. So he puts up a siding. And when that train with U.S. Grant came through and a lot of other dignitaries, among those dignitaries were a lot of these Yugoslavian investors. Qua wants to impress and thank these Yugoslavians. So what does he name the new community? Belgrade, as in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. And that's how Belgrade got its name. The community of what was once Moreland became Hamilton. And then in the 1890s, some beer masters from Germany send some scientists to North America. They need to find more sources of barley for their beer. German beer, I mean, the barley in Germany is amongst the best. But with the growing demand of German beer, and this would include people like Anheuser-Busch and all this kind of thing, they need to find more barley. And these scientists determined there were two places in North America that were the best for barley. One was up in Saskatchewan, and the other one was right out here in the middle of the Gallatin Valley. So some investors from New York City, one of them who went on to become one of the owners of the New York Yankees, these investors establish a malting plant here in Gallatin County. And the people of the small community of Hamilton are so overjoyed with this sudden economic windfall from the malting plant, they decide to change the name of their town to honor and thank the New York investors, most of whom were from Manhattan, Montana. That's how that happened. And the malters recruited a lot of Dutch people to come out and farm the barley. Then we get Amsterdam and Churchill and so forth. Three Forks had been there in one shape or the other. Earlier it was known as Shedd's Bridges. But with the railroad through here and then the growth of tourism, that's when Three Forks started to see some growth as a small railroad town and a tourist jumping off spot. The Milwaukee Railroad had a spur line from Three Forks to take you right down to the mouth of the Gallatin Canyon for tourists to get to Yellowstone Park. From roughly the mouth of the canyon to Yellowstone, you had to take a wagon in those days. Pretty rough road. Better have a good pillow for your fanny. They built the Sacagawea Hotel up there as a jumping off place. And then the Milwaukee Railroad decides they want one more jumping off place. Out here in the town of Salesville, which used to be called Slab Town because of all the slab wood that had been used to build houses in the early days. But its name became Salesville. The Milwaukee Railroad builds this very, very nice inn. And they call it the gateway to Yellowstone National Park. The good people of Salesville, they want to thank and honor the Milwaukee Railroad, so they change their name, Gallatin Gateway. And that's how you got Gallatin Gateway. So tourism, agriculture, the railroad, huge factors in some of the development of other portions of the valley. Now with Manhattan and the malting company, things went pretty good until Prohibition. And that kind of put the kibosh on the barley operation. So they said, well, what are we going to do? They figure out that not only is that a very good region for barley, it's also a pretty good region for seed potatoes. So they segue into growing seed potatoes. Idaho brags they've got all the great potatoes. That's fine, okay, but we know where your seeds came from. All right? So that's how Manhattan continued to get by and to grow. You talk about some of the other kind of interesting events in the history of this area, and I don't want to yak too long, but getting back to Nelson's story, when he was president of the Gallatin Valley National Bank, he had the Panic of 1892. But the banks was still pretty economically healthy. And a lot of banks in the country were closing. But before leaving for Los Angeles, Story has a meeting with the board of directors and says, look, I think we're okay. We're in good shape. But the bonds that we are holding in this bank, don't sell them. don't panic. We should be okay. If you guys want to sell those bonds, you let me know first. I want first crack at them, because he had the money to do it. So he goes to Los Angeles for the winter. He comes back. What did the bank board of directors do while he was gone? They sold all the bonds, because they were afraid of liquidity. They thought they were going to need that cash. Nelson Story calls the board of directors together and says, to hell with it, I'm closing the bank. There are other banks here. And Nelson Story, to his credit, he did see to it that every depositor got their money back, which was kind of unusual. You know, the same thing happened during the Great Depression. A lot of people couldn't even get the money they had already put in the bank, but he saw to it. One of the members of the board of directors was a physician. His name was Dr. Foster. He had performed the first successful cesarean operation west of the Mississippi. But he was also a member of the board of directors, and after Story closed the bank, Dr. Foster is overheard as saying, that Nelson Story, that's so-and-so. Somebody ought to take him out and hang him. Well, the word gets back to Nelson Story, what Foster said. So Nelson Story tells one of his sons, well, if they mean to hang me, I may as well face it standing up. So he goes downtown with his walking cane. He waits outside of Dr. Foster's office. Foster comes out of his physician's office, and then Nelson Story proceeds to beat the hell out of him with his walking stick. Dr. Foster threatens to sue him for assault and bring criminal charges. Nelson Story gives Dr. Foster $20,000 to drop the whole thing. Foster agrees because Foster can take the $20,000 and build Bozeman's first hospital. That's how this community got its first sanitarium slash hospital, an indirect result of Nelson Story kicking the hell out of some guy on Bozeman's Main Street. And that was not the first guy he had run-ins with. He had run-ins with Joe Lindley. Oh, gosh, those two. That was almost comical. Lindley always mad at Nelson Story for diverting water from Bozeman Creek over to his mill. And those two had a lot of fights and arguments. And Nelson Story one time beat the hell out of Lindley on Main Street, too. And then here we are at Lindley Park, which was part of the Lindley property. Who did they put a statue of in Lindley Park in the 60s? Nelson Story on his horse. Joe is still doing this in his grave, I swear, because those two could not get along at all. But looking back, it was really, really, really a Wild West town. It did start out as a cow town. There were gunfights in the saloon, the headquarters saloon back in 1877. A pair of brothers faced off. I think two guys were killed, and the other guy was acquitted, self-defense. I mean, it was just as dramatic and interesting as the gunfight at the OK Corral. The only problem was you didn't have anybody named Earp or Doc Holliday involved, so it really didn't get the publicity. But you had those kinds of things happen. And other interesting things, we should never, even though the roads get full of chuck holes sometimes, we should never complain too much, because before this road was paved, you can imagine the mud and the manure on Main Street. Merchants all along Main Street, at least once a day, starting late spring all the way up until the snow started to fly, at least once a day, if not twice, had to go outside with huge buckets of water and throw the buckets of water on their front windows just to get the mud and the manure and the gunk off. So you can imagine, you know. We certainly had our share of characters in this town, but also a lot of really, really hardworking people. As time goes by, other huge developments would be the establishment of Gallatin Field, Uncle Sam again. And then probably some would argue the most significant event in the history of this area was the establishment of Big Sky, because that really changed a lot of things. It really did. So. But anyhow, it's a community that started and still continues based upon an agricultural rural economy, and it has segued through the years into tourism, which is very important. And now, of course, we're seeing the effects of high tech. I saw in the paper this morning where they're going to build that new plant out by Manhattan. But I don't think the people of Manhattan will change the name of the town again. I think they'll probably just keep it Manhattan. I can I can take some questions. Maybe there's some things I didn't cover that we can just kind of kick around here. But before I do, here's the part everybody's been waiting for. This organization, the Gallatin Historical Society, is a 501c3 that operates this museum and publishes a lot of materials. We are not taxpayer supported. We don't get any money from the county, the city, or the state. We operate on admissions, memberships, donations. And so I ask you all to please consider a membership in the society. It is deductible to the extent allowed by law. Always got to get that in there. And if you become a member, you say, okay, what do we get? Free admission to the museum whenever you want to come in. 10% off anything you want to buy in the bookstore. And a subscription to our quarterly magazine. This last issue, we had an article in here about Doc Nelson, who lived here in Bozeman. He was the subject of Charlie Russell's famous painting, Riding the Bronc to Breakfast. This is a small magazine that just deals with the history of Gallatin County in southwest Montana. Again, four times a year it's mailed to you. And if you act today, complimentary, this is the Gallatin Collection Volume 2 coffee table book. And there's other really cool items that are available to you if you act today. I have to do this. It's the only way we keep the lights on and the doors open. But there's also a lot of other giveaways in here, including some back issues of the Pioneer Museum Quarterly. So please, if you can, we're going to need your support if we're going to continue onward. And some events coming up. We're going to have a historic book sale the first weekend in October. And we also have a signature quilt that local quilt makers are making that you can sign. And we're going to preserve it, and it'll be unveiled in December and then unveiled again through the years. It should last 100 years, and so it's an opportunity. We have one of those in stock. You can see Ellen Story's signature stitched in there along with Emma Weeks Wilson and some of the others. So anyway, stop in the bookstore, scope those things out, and just help us to continue on with our mission because it's going to really be important. Okay? Are there any questions? But we do also have a research library here. See, and that is also one of the benefits of this organization. We have family files. We have 17,000 photographs dealing with Montana, our history of this community. Some of them go back to the 1860s. And you can get recreations made. Here comes the capitalist in me. And whatever. But perhaps we can find the answer back there in the research center. After, Ellen Story died in 1924 and then Nelson died in 1926, their son, Walter P. Story, went on to be an important individual in the California National Guard. As a matter of fact, the military library, the official military library of the state of California, is called the Walter P. Story Library. So he relocated there. Their daughter, she relocated to Los Angeles. Nelson Story Jr. died of a stroke prematurely in the early 1930s, and that left Thomas Byron Story, who was known as Byne. Now, back in 1910, Byne bought that entire block on South Wilson. He was working at the mill. He had a lot of money, thanks to Dad, and he built that really, really nice house. And he invested heavily in sheep ranching. And things went good for the first 10 years, especially with World War I, the demand for wool for uniforms. But after World War I, the price of wool took a serious nosedive. TB, as he was known by friends, lost his shirt. He had to sell that house. That's when he sold it to the SAEs. He went broke. After the death of his parents, he and his wife and family lived for a while in there. And money-wise, things were still kind of tight. So they bought another house on South Wilson, and they agreed to sell it to the school district. TB did. Just couldn't keep it anymore. And then the school district wanted to expand Wilson School. And they said, well, that mansion's in the way. And besides that, during the school year, it'll block the sun and kind of goof up the sunlight in the school building. which is kind of lame because the sun drifts further and further that way during the winter. But people were hoping that the city would buy it to keep it as a museum. This was during the Depression in the 1930s. City didn't have the money. It was hoped the school district would try to preserve it. Now it's in the way. So the school district decided to tear it down. It's really too bad. And I think what happened to that building is part and parcel of the reason behind the effort, whether you agree with it or not, to preserve the one up on South Wilson. But keep in mind, yes, that was Story property, but only for 10 years. I mean, it does speak a lot to the agricultural wealth of the community. But this thing over here was torn down basically to make room for the school, and the Story family had just, the survivors had just kind of lost interest in it. There's pieces of it all around town. Let's see, there's a bar downtown that has the back door from the mansion they have in there, and there's other, I think, some private homes. The guy who tore it down sold off some pieces of the grand staircase and all of these other things. So it's around, but it's just been transplanted all over the place. You never know about it. With that guy, he had a Navy Colt pistol he always carried with him. And one time when he got in one of his arguments on Main Street with Joe Lindley, he pulled the pistol and with the butt of it nailed Joe right between the eyes. Knocked him down. And ever since then, he always called that pistol his old Lindleyizer. So, yeah, if they found a pistol, the Lindleyizer, the Story family over by Immigrant has it today. I got to see it. The thing about Story also that you have to remember is, okay, he became one of the wealthiest men in the territory slash state because of how he was. But he also did a lot for the community. He was the type, there was a family here, the husband was a drunk, always beating up on his wife and abusing their young son. He got him relocated, let him live rent-free, you know, until they could get back on their feet. He gave money to churches. He donated a lot of the land so MSU or so Bozeman could get that college. He really wasn't much of a church goer himself, surprise. But he did do quite a substantial amount to help churches get established. So thank you all for coming. Any support?